Welcome to Drunk as a Poet on Payday. I'm your host, Jason Gray. Today the show features Jesse Nathan, whose first book of poems, Eggtooth, was published recently by Unbound Editions, and has already won the 2024 New Writers Award in Poetry from the Great Lakes College Association. Nathan's poetry has appeared in the Paris Review, the American Poetry Review, and Kenyon Review, among other magazines, as well as in Best American Poetry 2024. His work has been supported by fellowships from the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation, Stanford University, and Breadloaf, and he's a 2024 LABA Bay Area Fellow. Nathan was a founding editor of the McSweeney's Poetry Series, and McSweeney's hosts his terrific Short Conversations with Poets interviews, which if you haven't read yet, you should go find those immediately after listening to the show.
Straw Refrain. Young gray cat huddled under the boxwood, only the eyes alert, oppressed to dirt. That hiss, the hiss of grasses hissing. What should? Blank road shimmers. On days like this, my mind, you hardly seem to be. On days like these. No. See that sidelong silver drum? That hiss is a sigh of the propane tank. 2 o'clock. You can smell it. Don't breathe that sigh. The creek's gone dry. Summer is wide as this wildered sky. Days like this. My mind, you hardly seem to be. Straw frail. No breeze. You had a theory that the birds would silence on a day like this. But the mocker's keenness and the kingbird and the vireos commence to warble on as heat bears down a day like this, my mind. You hardly seem to be. You rode. You creep.
Well, Jesse Nathan, thank you for joining me today on the podcast. Straw Refrain, it's a great opener to the book. It's Eggtooth is a tremendous book. It's really good.
Thanks for having me, Jason.
Yeah, and congratulations on winning that Great Lakes Award for the book recently. I hope many more accolades come for the book. It deserves them. So let's start at the beginning. How did Eggtooth come to be? How long were you working on it?
It's a great question, and I'm still making my way toward knowing the answer to it. On the one hand, with the first book, maybe this is true for lots of people, it feels like I've been writing it my whole life. The easy answer would be, my whole life, and it came to be out of my existence in that sense. But I would say, 10 or 15 years ago, I thought I was working on a first book, and there were many versions, and I'm not sure whether they are ought to be thought of as earlier drafts of this book or as 10, 12 different manuscripts. Some days I feel like it's all been one long process, and other times I feel like those were distinct attempts at books that then I shelved. There are gestures and poems and phrases and lines that go back 10 years or more. What happened maybe most specifically is that I wrote a poem in the 7-line stanza that I use a lot in this book. Just as a kind of one-off imitation of a John Donne poem stanza that I came across. He uses this 7-line stanza in The Good Morrow. And I wrote a poem. I was just a young poet imitating lots of poets, things that I liked. And I wrote that poem in probably 2009 or so. And it appeared in the American Poetry Review, and I sort of forgot about it. And then 7 years later, I remembered it, and I thought about trying another one in that stanza. And so I tried another one. And at the time I was thinking, I was revising my latest version of a manuscript. And I wrote one of these again in this 7-line stanza. And then it was so much fun. And I wrote another one, again, thinking I was just revising. And before I knew it, I had this whole new sequence that had sort of was being born inside of what I thought was a revision to another book. And that book fell away. It's like one of those bugs that goes into a plum or something, or, you know, and lays its eggs. And then it sort of grew up inside of this other manuscript. And before I knew it, I had this sequence of poems in the stanza, in the 7-line stanza, and added a few freer verse poems, other kinds of forms, quatrains, some older, some newer, but that sequence of poems in the John Donne stanza became the heart of Eggtooth. And before I knew it, I had this manuscript, and it felt like it was what I had been working toward. The interesting thing, I think, in some ways, is that period of intense work was probably about 18 months. But it's hard to say where it began and to disentangle it from all the other efforts that came about. But you know, I feel like the basic gestures, trying to figure out what to do with this life, this sense of this song, this sense of the world, this experience of being split between the middle America and a coastal version of American life, and wanting to carry them both and figure out the arc that connects them. That had been in my conscious and unconscious stew for most of my life.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that makes sense. So I wanted to ask you about that stanza structure and, you know, how it had come about. Because, you know, I was going to describe it for listeners as something like a Keatsian ode stanza that, you know, kind of indents in, out, and then 4 lines are longer, 3 lines are shorter. But actually, then as you read the book, you sort of get the nod in the title poem that it's from a Donne stanza. And so thank you for telling us where that came from. I was curious. Yeah. Did you rewrite any poems in your older versions of your manuscript into this form or anything as you, or were yeah. they just sort of, or sort of revisit yeah. ideas and cast yeah. them in this form?
That's so interesting. One or two, I think I did. Yeah, there were one or two. There's at least one that I can think of that I found had in it already a kind of latent rhyme scheme. Mm-hmm. And it was just a matter of nicking, you know, some of the phrases away and reconstituting it a little bit, mm-hmm. but not much. One thing that I did try to find different ways into the stanza. And at one of the poems, a longer piece in the book, I did write in prose first, or a prose version, and then shaped it into the 7-line stanzas. And that was sort of, I had read that Yeats had done that, and with some of his big longer poems, and it baffled me. I mean, I'd never thought of that, the idea that you could, that he, who I think of as such a musical poet, that some of those poems began as prose and wow. kind of wound their way into song. I thought, can that be done? Can I do that? Is that possible? And so with a fair amount of skepticism and not even imagining that it really would work out, I did that. But I loved how it emerged. And there was something about writing it in prose first, especially because there's a narrative element to that poem, that allowed me to kind of get the basics of story in place.
That makes sense.
And then to find the music. And of course, there was already there was already a lot of music in the prose. But as I was creating the prose, I was trying to not think of it as aiming to be a poem as much as possible. So it has a different texture to it, that one.
Yeah. This would be the long poem in the book, Between States, right?
That Abade Within Abade.
Oh, okay.
Is the one that's in prose.
Okay. Okay.
Between States is a different story, and it's interesting as well. And you've picked up on, it's really great. I haven't talked about this with anyone. You've picked up on these different ways that the poem, because many of the Eggtooth stanza, John Donne stanza poems emerged line by line in the seven line stanza, but some of them didn't. And Between States came about later in the process. It's the poem in which, to me, what I realized later, what was happening was that the form was disintegrating. The seven line stanza was no longer able to hold what I needed it to hold or to say what I needed to say. And I had been working with it at that point for more than a year intensively. And I was trying to write about two things at least with that poem, or there were two inchoate feelings developing. One was the sense that the way that people talk about Middle America is the metaphor that gets used is emptiness, flyover country. Yeah. And the sense that was, the more that I thought about that, the more ridiculous that seemed, given not only how much human life there is there and how much human life there has been there, but also all the non-human life that is, it's teeming. Those prairies are teeming with life and with all kinds of creatures. And of course that story of emptiness is one that has been told for a long time and was partly used to clear out the native populations that were there, you know, to say, well, this land is empty, it needs to be cultivated, etc. So I was thinking about that, and then I was also thinking about the ways that the grids, the straight lines that mark Middle America, the gridded roads, the way that they clash or interact or collaborate with or resist the meandering streams that flow through. There are these two kinds of movement, the streams and the straight roads, and they're both efficient in their ways. And a meandering stream is following the contours of the topography. And a straight line is getting you from point A to point B very quickly. And I came to sort of feel like my stanza, my strict, not that strict, but somewhat strict for me, seven line stanza was kind of a form of came from the same impulse in a way as the gridded roads, and that the freer verse poems, which I included a few of in the book, aligned themselves in some poetic or metaphysical way with the meandering streams. And Between States is the poem where those two modes clash, and the poem, which is about wandering, following a stream, breaks in and out of the stanza and a kind of freer mode. It goes back and forth between a stricter and a freer mode while thinking about trying to make visible all the teeming life of that prairie watershed that I grew up in. And so that poem became a kind of collision for the free and the strict, and also was the moment when the seven line stanza just simply wouldn't hold all that I was trying to represent and say. And so that one's almost the reverse, where it began in the seven line stanza and disintegrated into something much more sprawling. I wouldn't say prose, but I have heard it described as a kind of essay.
I could see that. Yeah. Well, and it ends. I mean, it ends so beautifully. I'm actually going to read this little end here. I love the way it begins, too, with the fire. But that end, it sort of seems like a bit of an Ars Poetica to me, if I don't know if you think of it that way, but imagining my stanza standing for the good within me while my lines run on like creeks across pastures, and then a land half imagined, half vanished, as a fog comes, not upon the earth, but out of it. And yeah, I read that as sort of like you trying coming to grips with not only what this personal sort of history was to you, but also like how you were going to write about it, I guess. And I don't know if that's, if I'm on to something there or not. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great poem. And I've read through it several times, and yeah, I hope people read that and recognize it, because it is really terrific. And I'm not surprised that you were working on it for a year or more. I mean, it's a big poem full of big ideas well executed.
Well, and it for a while the book was called Between States. So okay. For a while that was the title poem.
Sure.
The heart of the book. Yeah. I was working on it kind of in a low, which maybe is a theme, in a low level way, for the better part of a year, but there was a kind of ferocious month where I was mostly writing that poem. And so the actual composition was over the course of those few weeks, but these things are percolating long before one is even aware of it, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's take a break and have you read another poem for us. Can you read Shock?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Shock. As the storm moved in, I watched the night sky before I slept. A biblical clap woke the house to sprays of sheetrock, a powdered sprite springing from the nail heads, air flavored with ozone. In the hallway on the ceiling, a halo grew orange around a fixture, a glow, and Dad on the phone downstairs, and now shepherding the young ones out to shelter in the soap house, and Mom, who's usually sharp as a crack, fumbling in the pandemonium at the extinguisher. So I, small and spry, some ways slithered in up the crawl space and find a burning fan. Not just that fire-fanged attic fan. Wire, floor, rags, even wall studs chuckle in those flames. A company that almost comforts. Until I gag on smoke or fear and jerk the pin and aim a sweep of foam, blonde as bone, until it's dark and I'm alone. Some say it was lightning in a mineral bisque that triggered first light. Grandpa said in 1933 he lost 6 head, his life savings, to one strike. And I, in the soap house later with an EMT, would sense in the rafters swallows, veer, loop, follow, as if a shadow had a shadow.
Thank you. That's one of my favorites in the book. I just love that ending and the idea of a shadow having its own shadow. And this, the moment at the fire, in an amazing and terrifying moment as a kid, I suppose. I mean, I'm assuming this really happened to you. And that's one of the things, you know, the big things in the book. There's a lot of personal history, family history in here. So I'm, you know, about your growing up in Kansas and a lot of recurring characters, Justin, Ruth, Irina. And I'm kind of curious if you wouldn't mind talking about that, like mining your own personal history for your poems and how you go about doing that and what it means to you to do that and to deal with these real life situations and people in your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, well, so much of the book is rooted in my experience and in things that really did happen, such as the house getting struck by lightning. And at the same time, I do feel like it's a work of invention in the sense that poetry is always a kind of invention or an illusion. a lot of it is a lot of it is more or less transcribed from my experience and memories. But there is so much amalgamation and invention too, mm-hmm. and fiction. And so there is some daylight between me and the work, but I am a poet of the personal, experience and the personal memory. And I'm interested in trying to figure out what to do with our personal experience, how we make that visible, but visible perhaps in a useful way, or in a way that means something beyond our personal circumstances, to give candor some structure and form that is impersonal and beyond the individual life. Some of the names in the book are changed, but many of the things are rooted in my own encounters with the world. And I find it hard to make things up. I'm not really very good at that. But I do feel like the work of the imagination is sometimes simply the work of recreating what did happen. I used to think of imaginative work as meaning, when I was young, I thought, well, that means you made everything up, like a novelist inventing an entire world, in a sense. But then I realized that imagination is at work and essential just to, say, relating my day, how my day went, to a friend. Mm-hmm. I'm reimagining it. I'm reconstituting it, and I'm putting it into language. And even that act, even if I'm being 100 or trying to be 100% faithful to my recounting, it's still an imaginative act that changes what happened, the way that any re-remembering rewrites the memory. It's still changed by being put into language. Mm-hmm. And as a poet, I mean, I'm not a documentary poet, so I allow details to shift if they need to, for the sake of the story, mm-hmm. or for the sake of the music, or for the sake of the clarity of the lyric. I remember that an interviewer asked Leonard Cohen if one of his poems, his lyrics were true to life, true, you know, if they had truly happened. And I think he said, well, they're true enough.
Yeah, that seems about right. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is to say, they get at, they reveal something, and hopefully it's the thing that I find myself wanting to reveal or make visible or represent. They reveal something that is true, mm-hmm. in the way that art is the lie that tells us truth.
Right. Right. And I mean, I like that you put it in the form of invention. I mean, I think about that a lot, as even, and I don't necessarily write that much out of my personal life, but I'm thinking about reading poems that people do. I mean, like, even when they're very autobiographical, I mean, they're still putting a frame on it, still putting some kind of shape on it. And that is inevitably turning it towards a fiction, you know, turning it towards an imaginative, you know, act.
And the shaping, yeah. The frame, I think, is so important, the invention. And the art in artifice.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The artifice in art.
Right. Exactly. Well, I wondered it too. I mean, so, you know, we've talked about this being, you know, drawn out of your past a lot and your youth. And of course, maybe you could talk about the title, Egg Tooth, where that, what that is, that comes from, and how that might relate to the subject of these poems.
Mm. Well, the egg tooth is a bit of cartilage that forms on a baby bird's beak. Actually, I think all reptiles. Hmm. And it forms when they're in the egg before they've hatched. And it's this little protrusion that allows them to break free from the shell, without which they would be stuck in there. I mean, a shell is a formidable thing, and they're, you know, they're little creatures. And so they use the egg tooth to cut their way out, to knock their way out. And then once they're born, the egg tooth evaporates. disappears.
Oh, evaporates.
So it's got this kind of one-time use, mm-hmm. And it became a figure, an important figure for me, for emergence and mm-hmm. birth and rebirth and beginning. Maybe all first books are mm-hmm. kind of about emerging.
Right.
But it certainly is a part of this book and about leaving the place that you had been, one of the places that I had been formed in, mm-hmm. leaving that world for another world, taking flight in a sense. The other thing is that it became bound up in this stanza that mm-hmm. I'm using, that I found myself thinking of the stanza as a kind of egg tooth, as a way to break
nice.
Free of my silence as a poet, or right. from the silence. And so the title poem wraps those things together, I think. The idea of an egg tooth and the idea of breaking free as a poet, emerging as a writer.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Yeah. I mean, when I got my hands on the book, I was like, I got to find out what egg tooth is about and stuff. And it's really fascinating. I didn't know that about birds and reptiles and anything in an egg that would have that. But of course, yeah, they'd need it to get out. That's pretty amazing. Well, I got one more question for you. So you've just published a book recently. How are you celebrating?
Well, I've been enjoying reading the book all over the place, and
awesome.
And I enjoy the reading. But what makes them feel celebratory, those travels, is seeing old friends, mm-hmm. meeting new people, and enjoying the kind of the journey of those travels. You know, taking time to explore. I read in Scotland.
Sort of
wander around in Scotland. Karen Soli took me to the Keipley Caves, subject of her book.
That's great.
And things like that. Eating decadently.
Outstanding.
You know, sleeping in a nice feather bed on the road. Those are the ways that I've celebrated.
And that's great.
And feel, you know, it's hard for me to be far from home in some ways.
Okay.
I am a sort of home body. I like mm-hmm. my study and my
sure
to be with my people and my books.
Right.
And so it's been fun to celebrate by leaning into the travels with mm-hmm. the book and where the book takes me, and to kind of raise a glass at many tables, near and far.
Excellent. Well, that's a great way to do it. I'm glad you've gotten to do that. That's terrific. Well, thank you again, Jesse, for speaking with us. Would you take us out with another poem?
Absolutely. I'll read the last poem.
All right. Sounds good to me.
This long distance. Sunday, in his grandmother's time, had been the day you went visiting. Noontime news topped with beet borscht and pickled pig's feet, cottage cheese stuffed in pancakes and spudding, silly talk, and coffee. His art with his hopes had conspired to conduct him many states away, but even now when Sunday's here, he calls his kin. And when he'd call his parents, his dad would begin with weather. 5 inches since Friday, 7 3/10 since Monday. It may even hock up more. And his mother would inveigh, or other times dial up other composings. First frost came, so we picked up the hoses, slid the barn door closed. Any minute now we'll get fresh straw for the stalls. Or she'd say how they butchered the hens. One had a clot of new eggs in her, ready to lay. Or she might tell stories of Aunt Larry, who never married and carried a snuff box. Or Dad would describe having recycled faxes that had blankened, each message returned to the ether. And then the sun might describe a minus tide, or tell how his shoulder, tattooed, has haired over, as if his swallow flies in a thicket. Or he'd ask, how low is the well? Or what kind of locust, again, is the swing tree? And so forth. They'd sneeze, cough, mention the soap house had had to be raised, or that the catamaran was trounced in a squall, or how their bodies were giving out. An organ recital, they'd call it. And he, drinking coffee, might offer as balm the lights up the hills in the night in his city, described as the winkings of great piles of embers. And his mother might report on emerald leaves, emerald wheat, high leaning cloud banks. Or his father might say that the starlings were mustering the pasture. They could murder if they wanted. And the sun, not really sure then what to say, says an iconic radio tower from where he sits presents like a cone jelly. And they, who in his imagination are in the dining room he knows well, hold up their phone up against the back window to let him hear the call, so personal and clear, of the train out there.
Thank you to Jesse Nathan for joining me on the show today. Check out the show notes to find out more about Jesse's work and to pick up your own copy of Eggtooth. If you like what you heard, leave us a review, subscribe, and share with your friends. This was Drunk as a Poet on Payday. Thanks for listening.